I think that when we get that time that we spend together every week when we gather that we call community time, I think is one of the greatest gifts that a community of this kind and size has to offer to one another. It's not the last word, but it's a good, strong one. It's an important one. And I always feel, at the risk of sounding, you know, paternalistic, I think in a good way, that's sort of how I feel. I feel really proud of this community when we kind of bite the inside of our cheek because we're afraid of how this might come off and speak anyway, you know, and when we say the hard stuff and we get to pray for one another. I don't know a lot of ways we could improve on that opportunity. I'm not talking technically improve. I'm just talking about the opportunity itself and how important it is. Jeremy, your story, where'd you go?
Right here.
Okay, there we go. So talking to no one here. I mean, anytime we suffer, it's unique to us. And anytime we suffer, it's also part of the human story, right? I mean, this is the world we live in. And these things that are not expected happen. And the things that bring suffering and trauma, as well as the things that we do expect. You know, these two deaths that are both mentioned, neither one of those a surprise, but still a shock and still a trauma. It's interesting that in, seems like in every story of collective trauma or disaster, group trauma or disaster, there seem to be tales of both selfishness and heroism. I don't know if you have followed the story of this sinking of this cruise ship, which, I mean, I'm not laughing about the deaths, but there's a part of this story that's just plain ridiculous. You know, tell you what, let's see how close we can go to the island. Like, there's something just so patently absurd about the whole story. And of course, in the middle of that story is the story of the captain abandoning ship. I love the unfolding of this because this guy is trying so hard to spin this, and the world's just not buying it. And it's curious. I won't go into this in any great detail, but of course, captain's abandoning the ship before being the last one off, or at least in the case of a commercial cruise liner, before the passengers have been safely dealt with, has happened before. So it's not the first time a captain's jumped over the rail before he legally and morally ought to. Nor is it the first time that someone has tried to find a way to tell the public that story and have them accept it. And in fact, and this is really kind of got me chuckling this week, this guy is basically telling the story as though, and sort of his words, as though he basically tripped and fell into a lifeboat. And it sailed. And he just couldn't help it. That happens, yeah. And in fact, historically, it has happened before that a captain has told this tale. It was in the 1800s. But he actually had this, the 1800s captain had a lot more political acumen, and he found a way to tell the story that was much more believable and actually salvaged his career, which I think is probably what this guy's hoping is going to happen. But tripping and accidentally falling into the lifeboat doesn't explain being caught on shore wrapped up in a blanket to hide your insignia, does it? And so he's got a little explaining to do. I don't think it's going to work. If I was a betting man. But along the way in that same story, we come to this 57-year-old guy, Manrico, the hospitality director for the ship. Manrico behaved more like the captain of the ship than the captain of the ship did. This guy was discovered about a day and a half after the sinking of the ship in a partially submerged restaurant. He stayed behind to help passengers into lifeboats, but then when the ship tipped over, he fell and he broke his leg. And he was, at that point, deep enough in the ship that his cries for help weren't heard, and so he had to actually wait there until the rescuers started searching the ship and found him. It seems like as human beings, we're complicated in this regard. We seem to be able, as individuals and collectively, we seem to be able to contain both great good and great evil. And sometimes it seems like those things come out within moments of one another. I thought a few years ago now, but the movie Crash was a fairly interesting and forceful exploration of this, really worth seeing in that regard. Well, we're in Genesis, and maybe for years, but that's okay. So when we think about who humans are and why we behave the way that we do, it's not a bad idea to go back to our Genesis, to go back to our beginnings in the story. And there's a lot that we can learn in the actual account of Genesis about ourselves as humans, things that help us to begin to make sense of ourselves and our behavior, of, among other things, this apparent two-facedness, this great capacity for good and for evil. We left off, if you were here last week, we left off in verse 3 with God making light. And as the story unfolds, God makes the sky and he makes the land and he makes the vegetation, the sun, the moon, the stars, aquatic life, bird life. And then on the sixth day, we get to the beginnings of the human story. And it's interesting that in the biblical poem, we're latecomers to the story, which I find uniquely intriguing because it's one of those intersections, and we talked about the whole faith and science question a fair bit last week, but this is one of the intersections in this story where science and belief, if you will, or faith tell us the same story. They both say we're latecomers, that we're not the first chapter in the story. Mm-hmm. And I think that's an interesting thing. And just to help us keep our perspective in the biblical story, we might want to note that not only are we latecomers, but as the poet tells the story, we don't even get a whole day to ourselves. We are part of the larger narrative, as Genesis tells it, of God making all the land-based life. This is the way the Genesis account actually tells the tale of those days. And God said, "Let the land produce living creatures according to their kinds, livestock, creatures that move along the ground, and wild animals, each according to its kind." And it was so. God made the wild animals according to their kinds, the livestock according to their kinds, and all the creatures that move along the ground according to their kinds. And God saw that it was good. That's day 6. We're going to keep going, I promise. But isn't it interesting that God, in this primal tale of creation, has so much range? He makes the land, he makes the vegetation, the light, and all those kind of things. He makes the domesticated animals, which is a very interesting piece of storytelling, isn't it? God also makes, and this is the range I was talking about, God also makes the wild animals in this story. There's a kind of a neo-folk Canadian outfit that's very popular in our house called the Bills. And a fabulous band. They've got this wonderful song on an album of theirs called Let 'em Run, the title track of which is about keeping illegal chickens in your backyard in Vancouver. But anyway, the song is called, we won't talk about that song this day. The song in question is called Bamfield's John Vanden, and it's a story, it's a classic folk song in the sense that it tells an actual story of a person, a real person, in this case this old West Coast fisherman, a guy named John Vanden, lives in Bamfield. It's a guy who spent his entire life working on the sea, and he knows the sea. And the lyrics of the chorus go like this: "And you might slip and stumble on the rocks at the shore and exult in the blast of the mighty wake's roar, but when you stand humbled at the ocean's door, then you'll understand just who I am. Bamfield's John Vanden." The song goes on to talk about what it's like to face the wildness of the sea, to realize that you are dwarfed by its power, to realize that you are dwarfed by its wildness, to be humbled by that. When he talks about standing at the ocean's door, he's not talking about standing on the beach. He's talking about standing in that delicate space that we occupy in creation as humans, where we recognize the power of creation is far greater than ours, and we live just barely in this moment. That's what he's talking about. And he says that if you want to understand me, if you want to understand my lifelong love affair with the sea, you have to face into that humbling wildness with me. You have to be willing to go to that place. You have to feel what it's like to spend every day fully engaged in a world that you treat with respect, with a world that you cooperate with, rather than a world that you conquer. Then you'll understand just who I am. Bamfield's John Vanden. That's an intriguing song to me, not least of all, because it's so deeply resonant with the exact kind of things that we find in those two verses we just read in Genesis chapter 1. The creation story, as we find it in our Christian scriptures, takes some pains to mark the powerful wildness that God has made. And that's important to us in terms of understanding ourselves as humans and our human experience for a few different reasons. One of them is that when we think about God, we tend to, most of us, I think most of the time, I think this is fair, we tend to think about God as domesticated. We tend to think about God as somebody who resides in nice buildings and nice ideas and nice theologies and ideologies. We tend to think about God as the kind of being that resides in things that foster certainty of belief and certainty of practice. Now, there is something ineffably lovely about being certain. What a lovely way to live. You've heard me before distinguish between certainty and confidence, and so I'm not going to recover that ground right now, but I think it's a super important distinction. But on the side of this way of thinking about God as domesticated, the danger on that side, if you will, is that it feeds into arrogance. It feeds into, I know what is right and true. I know how this world works. I know how God works in it. Here's the problem. That way of thinking about God or believing in God does not take into account either the way the world seems to work or our own sacred texts of how the world has worked from the beginning. Because from the beginning of the story, where we're parked here in chapter 1, verse 24 and verse 25, we haven't gotten far into it, and already at this point in the story, we're in a world that is made by God. But it's in the context of a larger story that we come into this tale. We come into this tale as part of the created order. We're a unique part. We're going to talk about that in a moment. But we're not a part that exists outside of the rest of the story. We're not in a bubble in this story. And we live sometimes like we're in a bubble, as though we were exempt from the greater realities of the story. But we're not. And if we're wondering, pay attention. We didn't even get a full day. The poet knew. Poet just put us in there with the rest of the animals. Not because we're not unique. I said we'll come to that. But because we're part of the larger story, because we're not made in a bubble, we are not exempt from the wildness, we are not exempt from the untamedness of this story.
Come on.
That's right, Trevor. Yeah, it's true, man. I believe it. It's nice to have company. In real stories, you guys, in real stories, unexpected things happen. And the big story of the Bible is a real story, and we can sense the depth of the truth that it tells in moments like this one, moments that acknowledge that all is not tamed. All is not predictable. All is not subject to our limited wills. That's the world that we live in from the beginning of the story. And it's implicit in that line of thinking that God's self would not be subject to us either. But God would be capable of things that seem to us wild and unpredictable. From the beginning of the story, it's been this way. And right now, some of us are twitching inside because we have been relentlessly trained on the idea that God is the same yesterday, today, and forever. And indeed, the Bible says as much in so many words, and that particular text is found in Hebrews chapter 13. The passage in which it's found, for a little context, opens this way. Keep on loving one another as brothers and sisters. Do not forget to show hospitality to strangers, for by doing so, some people have shown hospitality to angels without knowing it. Continue to remember those in prison as if you were together with them in prison, and those who are mistreated as if you yourselves were suffering. And then this text goes on to remind us of the importance of moral purity, in the context of marriage in particular. Goes on to remind us to be content rather than dissatisfied with our material lives, with our stuff. And particularly, it goes on to remind us not to be unhappy with how much money we don't have. Good, solid, practical stuff, you know. Grounded. That's grounded and grounding kind of stuff. And then, and this is where this gets interesting in light of God is the same yesterday, today, and forever. The text answers that human question that I wrote about in my email this week. Why? Right? This is kind of this pivotal question. And the Hebrews text answers the implicit question, which is why should we do all this? Why should we, in fact, show hospitality to strangers? Why should we care for those in prison as though we ourselves were there? Why should we care for those that are suffering? Why should we actually try to keep our marriages sacred and pure? Why should we be content rather than discontent with our material lives? Why should we do all of this? Because, Hebrews says, and this is straight from that text, this is how it goes on, because God has said, so this is the rationale, never will I leave you, never will I forsake you. So we say, the writer of Hebrews says, so we say with confidence, the Lord is my helper, I will not be afraid. What can mere mortals do to me? And it's in the next verse that we're reminded that Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. Now, who are these people in this Hebrews text that are being reminded that God can be trusted, that God can be depended on with confidence? What's their situation? This is their situation. These are people that are being tossed into prison for their faith. These are people that are suffering the kind of poverty that means they need help from others in order to survive in the world. These are the kind of people that are wrestling with what it means to keep their marriage intact, that are struggling with what it means to live a life of sacred sexuality. That's who the writer of Hebrews is saying you can be confident in God's sameness to. These people that the writer is making that statement about God's sameness, yesterday, today, and forever, live in this world, in the wild one, not in a tamed one, not in a domesticated one. But they live in a story where the unexpected happens. It's to those people that our sacred text says, be confident in God. Isn't that interesting? I want us to note, at least briefly, some of the characteristics of God that the writer singles out. The writer of Hebrews says we should be confident in God because God is consistent in God's non-abandonment and God's help. Those are the characteristics of God that the writer of Hebrews says are the pivot of why we should be confident in God's care. Those are the kind of things that matter to those that are having experiences where those exact kinds of things might get called into question. Because we do have those kind of experiences, and we do call those things into question. This is who we are. Those are the kinds of things that happen in a world that isn't entirely tamed and subdued. Those are the kind of things that happen on the watch of a God that, although deeply, consistently caring and good, apparently does not have making the world a predictable, entirely domesticated place as his top priority. It is not, listen, if you don't take away anything else in terms of my conviction about this text this morning, take this. It is not God's eradication of wildness or his shielding us from it that is the same yesterday, today, and forever. It is his being with us through that wildness as a companion and a helper, unlimited by the things that limit us as mortals. That's the hinge of the story. And we learn that to be true right from the beginning, right from the genesis of the human story in creation. That's the context in which we come to humanity's introduction into the Genesis story in verse 26. Then God said, Let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish in the sea and over the birds in the sky, over the livestock and all the wild animals, and over all the creatures that move along the ground. Still room left for wildness. I don't know if you were here last week, or if you were, if you caught the lyrics to the tune that Brian sang for us. We're working on making things more intelligible right to the back of the room. And I promised in that email that there would be an improvement. I think there is. It's not the improvement I had in mind, because part of the solution didn't work this morning. So, full disclosure from the sound guy as well as the preacher. But we'll continue on that path, and it'll be even better next week if I can pull it off. That said, in case you missed the lyrics, one of the verses in that song was this: built on a Friday, and you can't fix me, can't fix me, can't fix me. I was built on a Friday, and you can't fix me. Even so, I've done okay. It has long been rumored that it is a bad idea to buy a car that was built on a Friday. And the rationale is that, you know, everybody's working for the weekend and not really paying a lot of attention. And there's more likely to be substitutes on the production line, and they don't usually put that part on, so it's upside down. You know, it's just a bad idea. That's the history of that. I think that particular metaphor has lost some of its force in a culture where most of the car is built by a robot who doesn't care if it's Friday or not. Nevertheless, in the creation story, we are a day six product. We're a Friday product. We were built on a Friday. It doesn't seem to have deterred our Maker from giving us a very special identity, core to which is the truth that we come to next in the text, which is that we are made in the image of God. And the language is very evocative. The language is this: then God said, let us make man in our image, in our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, over the livestock, over all the earth, over all the creatures that move along the ground. It's not a grammar glitch, that us in there, but it is interesting and evocative language, isn't it? What does it evoke? That us, let us make mankind in our image. Well, different biblical scholars have made a variety of suggestions about what the us and the we there signifies. One of my own cherished ideas actually came pretty seriously under scrutiny and suffered a little in the course of my study of this text. If you've been around here any length of time, you know that I'm pretty committed to this idea of God as three yet one. I think it's essential to us as understanding, for understanding ourselves and how to think about what it means to live well together in this world. And so for me, the we and us in this text has always been redolent with that imagery of God as triune. But of course, the idea of God as triune was nowhere on the horizon for the people for whom this text was written. That idea would not have been part of their picture of imagining the character of God at all. And while there may be some real resonance with that as we unfold the story over the text's breadth, I don't think that's what's going on here. At least it wouldn't have been for the people for whom it was written. There are some scholars that would suggest that the Jewish people who lived in a time where the cultures around them believed in many gods, but the Jews, believed in one God, that the we here is a way of the poet trying to bring together the many into one and the language reflecting that. I think that's got some merit. There are other scholars that would say that the we here, and this is sort of where the preponderance of the scholarship comes down, that the we here is the royal we. That this is, as Victoria, you know, famously applied it, we are not amused. It's that we. You think too much of yourself. Perhaps, Victoria. In any event, the verses go on to say that this we has deliberately made us in its image for the express purpose, and this is why I think that's the most defensible understanding of the we here, for the express purpose of permitting us to rule over all that is made. Again, this is a good poem. It's worth paying attention to the words. It's worth paying attention to the ideas that the writer of this text, like John Vanden, has somehow or other in his life, and this is my sense, this is not defensible from the text, I don't know who the writer or writers are, but there's a sensibility about the text that the writer has stood at the ocean's door. That the writer has stood somehow in creation in a way that has humbled them, that has humbled this story, that has placed it in the context of wildness, of the untamed, of the uncontrollable possibility. And so when the writer tries to find language to say God has charged us with rulership, the writer chooses to say that God has permitted us to rule this kind of a world together with God. Isn't that fascinating? We'll talk another day about the abuse of this text because it has been badly misapplied, not least of all in our near history as humans, the Industrial Revolution, and some of those things, many of which in the Western mind and world worldview have been unfolded into the creation based on this text that says that our job is to subdue the earth. And the misapplication of that idea is something that the generation that sits here every morning that is 20-something, the generation that lives in my house that is 18 to 8, when I talk to my kids, I'm just like, you know what? You guys are going to, this is part of what you inherit. You inherit the echo of the misunderstanding of the word subdued and the misapplication of it throughout the created order. And it's going to be a hell of a problem to solve. We are permitted by God to co-rule creation. The writer of Genesis says that creation is God's territory, God's kingdom. And that we are made to share his rulership over the kingdom of all that is made. Now that is a picture that is full of rich possibilities, both for good and for not good. And that's where we live. And that takes us right back to the beginning of where we started this morning, to our capacity for both great good and great evil. If we are beings that are made to share the rulership of creation with the Creator, how have we done? How are we doing? How will we do? And what will we draw upon to do better rather than worse? To bring life rather than death? If we wake up in the morning and before we put our feet on the floor, we remind ourselves that we are part of God's unfolding creative project in the world. And then we walk out the door and try to figure out how we're going to practice that. How is it? What will guide us so that we do better than we've done? Well, that's, in many ways, that's the short approach to why we would bother to live the life of a disciple, to why we would bother to try to figure out together what it was like for Christ to walk in the world when Christ did, and then what it's like for us to walk in the world like Christ would if Christ lived in our time as us. And then to go and help one another to do that, regardless of what kind of wildness the story brings. Because it's bringing wildness. If you were wondering, just all you had to do was pay attention in our community time. This is where we live. This is where we've lived from the beginning of the story. This is the context in which the writer of Hebrews, close to the end of the biblical story, says, you can count on God not to make the world unwild, not to domesticate creation, but to never abandon and to always be standing right there in the story, ready and willing to help when we stand at the ocean's door.